Well, when you think about boxes, things that you put in a box, what is the first thing that comes to mind? Maybe pizza? Or hopefully I'm not making you hungry right before lunch. Or chocolate? Those are the things that come to my mind. Maybe you think about toys. Toy box, some here. Or you think about a box truck, right? You can put lots of things, hundreds of things in a box truck. Or maybe a big box store. Well, in a big box store, you can put thousands of things, maybe tens of thousands of things. And really, when you think about boxes, we could just keep going and going and going. But no matter how big we make the box, it's impossible to create a box so big that you can fit God into it. And so often, this is what we like to do. We like to try to create scenarios, compartmentalize God so that we can understand Him, so that we can control Him. There's a famous theologian, his name was Augustine of Hippo, and he was writing a book on the Trinity. Now, this is like the 4th century, maybe 4th or 5th century, and he's writing this book on the Trinity, and as he's walking down the beach, he sees a little boy, and the little boy is digging feverishly into the sand. And he said to the little boy, "What are you doing?" The little boy said, "Well, I'm digging a hole big enough to fit the whole ocean in it." Well, then Augustine kind of laughed as he heard that, and then he thought, you know, that's exactly what I'm doing when I'm writing this book on the Trinity. I'm trying to take the immensity of the Godhead, and I'm trying to fit His ways and who He is into my tiny little brain. And if you know anything about Augustine, he had a giant brain, but compared to the immensity of God, it was a small thing, minuscule thing. But we do this all the time. And this is exactly kind of the background of the passage that we're looking at. And this passage explodes our understanding of our desire to try to control God and fit Him into maybe His ways and what He does in a way that makes Him controllable. God will not be controlled by any of His creatures. Well, for any of you who weren't here a few weeks ago, we began looking at the book of Job together, and you'll remember that God called together divine counsel. And we have examples of God calling divine counsels together in the Bible. Psalm 82 is one example. And this is when He calls together His angelic beings, and then He sends them out, and they do work in the cosmos, just as God calls us to do His work on the earth. Well, God called this divine counsel of angelic beings, and lo and behold, guess who shows up? The devil shows up. And then God, in the course of this conversation, asked him if he considered his servant Job as a man who is wise and godly. And Satan said, "Yeah, I know who Job is, but the only reason why he loves you is because you placed a hedge of protection around him. You keep him safe. He's prosperous. He's wealthy. He's got a wonderful family. He's got it all. And you take that away from him. You take away his possessions from him, and he'll curse you to your face." And so as the story goes, God said, "Okay, I'll allow you to do that. You go and you can take his possessions." And so Satan began by destroying Job's possessions, his livestock. He killed his servants. But worst of all, his children. He had 10 children, and they were all struck in one terrible accident when a roof collapsed upon them, and they were all killed. And so at this point, Job had lost everything, all of his possessions, all of his wealth. But as we read the text, he didn't curse God. So God calls another divine counsel together, and lo and behold, guess who shows up? Satan shows up, and God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And he says, "Well, yeah, he didn't curse you to your face, but that's because you didn't touch his body. It's skin for skin. Human beings are selfish. They can handle losing everything else, but when you go after them personally, that's when they've got a problem." Like, taking out his 10 children wasn't personal, right? And so then God said, "Okay, Satan, have at it. Just don't take his life." And Satan attacked Job with physical illness, physical distress. He had sores from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet. And at this point, he was broken, he was destitute, and then finally the last blow kind of in that whole segment came when his wife came to him and said, "Job, curse God and die." She became Satan's instrument to attack Job. And at the end of all of this, Job did not curse God. So then Satan now is using another weapon against Job. And those are his friends. And these people really cared about Job. They made an appointment with each other. They were from different countries. Think about this. This book was written. This is the setting of this book is sometime between 2000 A.D. and B.C. and 1000 B.C. This is a book that's set in a time that's at least 3,500 years ago. These guys had to make plans with each other so that they could meet up at the same time. They're from different countries and they could go and meet Job there. And so for 7 days, they sat with Job as he sat by the town rubbish heap in misery and pain and suffering. And this is significant. The 7 days is significant because normally that's the period of time that you would take to mourn the dead. 7 days, 7 nights. And so it was as if Job was a dead man in this story. And there they were with him. They were true friends. They cared about him, but they became Satan's instruments to attack him. Now, when we read the story, if we look at chapter 4 at the very beginning, we notice that the first friend of his speaks. His name is Eliphaz. And in chapter 4, 3 and 4, he says this. He starts well. "Behold, you have instructed many and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have made firm feeble knees." And so Eliphaz begins by admitting that Job has helped people in tremendous ways. And so now he begins with that, words of kindness, but it goes downhill from there. See, Eliphaz had God in a box. The suffering of Job made sense to Eliphaz because he believed that Job did certain things that led to the demise that he was in. He said, "Job, this is the way it works. What goes around comes around. If you do A, God is going to do B. There's a correlation. If you serve him faithfully and honorably, he's going to bless you. If you do something sinful, he's going to come down on your head and he is going to pounce on you. And obviously, Job, you are suffering terribly. You've lost all of these things. It must be because God is mad at you." It's something that people in the ancient world held to adhere to. They still do today. And people even in our culture today still adhere to this. You find it very commonly in the prosperity gospel, the health and wealth gospel, maybe the Benny Hinn's of the world. You hear it in the Joel Osteen's of the world. You hear it in the Kenneth Copeland's of the world. This idea that if you do certain things, God is obligated to give you certain things. Theologians call it the law of retribution. Some people call it the law of sowing and reaping. But the problem is that all of these people in modern days, these people in the ancient world, is they're putting God in a box and they're telling him, obligating him on the way that he should operate in people's lives. We know that this couldn't be further from the truth. I remember once talking to a woman and she was sure that her daughter was going through a divorce was going to come out on the right end and that everything that she wanted was going to happen. I said, how can you be so sure about that? And she said, "Well, I sent in my seed money." She was watching television. There was a prosperity gospel preacher on the television. And the prosperity gospel said, "Send in your seed money and God will do for you whatever you want him to do." And she said to me, "God is obligated. He has to do it. I sent in my seed money and he has to give me that result." Well, this is the same idea. This is the same fallacy that Eliphaz bought into and Job's friends bought into. And I hope that if you're ever tempted to be pulled in by those kinds of people who teach these kinds of things, that if you do certain things, God is obligated to do things in your life. I hope that you think about the book of Job, because Job was the apple of God's eye. I mean, Job was the one that God brought up to Satan as, "Have you considered my servant Job? I mean, he's wise. He is godly. He's a righteous man." The things that were happening to Job weren't happening to him because he had done anything wrong. The things that were happening to Job were happening to him because he was in such tight fellowship with God. And so We can see him articulated. If you look at chapter 4, verses 6 through 8, he says this, "Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed." You see, Eliphaz had God in a box. He assumed that if certain things were happening to Job, then God must have been doing it for a certain reason. And he assumed that it was because he plowed iniquity and sowed trouble, and therefore was reaping the same. Now, I think we need to be clear. There is this principle of sowing and reaping in the Bible. And that's what makes things like this so enticing, because people who share falsehoods, what they do is they mix truth with error, and then we're prone to believe their falsehoods because we know that there's some truth in it. I mean, if people tried to share with us beliefs they tried to propagate on us some false belief, and they only used false premises, well, then we wouldn't believe them at all. So what do? You take a little bit of truth, you take a little bit of error, you mix them together, and then you have false teaching. And this is particularly what we see happen in this. So there is a sowing and reaping principle in the Bible. For instance, Hosea 8:7. "For they sow the wind, and they shall also reap the whirlwind." You ever heard that one? Maybe from your mom? You sow the wind, you're going to reap the whirlwind. I've heard that a few times in my life, and it's good to reflect on. Or we have Hosea 10:13. "You have plowed iniquity, you have reaped injustice. You have eaten the fruit of lies because you have trusted in your own way and in the multitude of your warriors." Or we have another example of sowing and reaping, Galatians 6:7. "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap." Or we have Jesus. These are the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 6:3-4. "But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you." So we do have this principle of sowing and reaping in the Bible. But the key thing that we need to be careful about is turning it into some ironclad law. And that's what Eliphaz did. Jesus explodes this whole idea. There's a story where he passed by a man who was blind from birth. In John chapter 2, it tells us, or John chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, we kind of read what happens. His disciples have a question. You see, in Jesus' day, people accepted this idea. If you were blind or you had some kind of other ailment, it must have been because you did something wrong. You did something to deserve it, and so now God is punishing you. But the problem was, if somebody's born blind, I mean, how do you explain that? Did the person do something wrong, like in their mother's womb? Or is it because something their parents did? And so this is exactly what they asked. And the disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him." What is Jesus saying? The reason that the man was born blind wasn't because he did anything wrong or his parents did anything wrong. It was for that moment when Jesus was passing by so that he could display his glory in him and he could heal him. And that even now, 2,000 years later, we're telling the story of this glorious thing that Jesus did. Sometimes God allows difficulty in our lives for a greater purpose. And that's exactly what we notice in Job's life. God had a greater purpose in Job's suffering. In fact, his suffering has helped people through the ages, like us, when we go through our times of suffering and difficulty. It's sort of like the rules that we have, the law, the principle of sowing and reaping is sort of like the principles that we have in our own culture and time. For instance, many of you may be familiar with a famous study that the Brookings Institute did. If you want to make sure that you avoid living in poverty, basically three simple rules. Now, this is a secular think tank, but it's interesting. If you want to make sure that you avoid poverty, three things. Number one, finish high school. Number two, get a full-time job. Number three, get married and have kids in that order, and you're not going to live in poverty. Now, all of us can look at that and say, well, we know exceptions to that rule, don't we? I knew a guy who did a PhD at Harvard University. He taught at Harvard University. His wife had a PhD from Harvard University, and both of them lived in poverty. So you have somebody who had this advanced degree from the most amazing place, and he lived in poverty. It isn't like this rule that is ironclad. It's a principle. It's something that science tells us, but it isn't always the case. Well, in the same way, these principles of sowing and reaping that we have in Scripture are God can't overrule any of these things anytime He so chooses. I remember hearing a story about a man. Actually, was told by a professor of mine who taught the book of Job to me. His name is Dr. Dennis McGarry, wonderful professor, amazing storyteller, and beautiful class in the book of Job. But he told the story of a student who had come in a former class, and he didn't recognize a student. And the student was obviously not a seminary student. And so for some reason, he wanted to take his class on Job. So this professor went and he met with him, and he wanted to find out from him, why was it that he was in the class? And the man said, a few years ago, I was driving in my car with my wife and my children. We got into a car accident, and my wife died, and my kids died, and I was broken. And one day I was home, I was all alone, my family gone, and I hear a knock at the door, and I felt some relief when I realized that it was my pastor. My pastor was there, and it was the church leadership was there, and they came in the house, and we all sat down together. And then maybe they prayed together. I don't remember. And then he said the first words that came out of my pastor's mouth were, what did you do wrong? What did you do wrong to cause this to happen? Well, he said he was broken when he heard this. He couldn't imagine that he had done anything that would have led to this. And so he wandered away from the Lord, and he walked away from his church, and he said, going to this class was a return. He felt God tugging his heart, calling him back. And this was part of the process where the Lord was bringing him back. And so, you know, when we watch television and they say, you know, the TV preachers say, you know, if you give me lots of money, you're going to be rich. And that sounds all good and well. But on the other hand, they say, if you have sickness, if you have poverty, it means that you don't have enough faith. It means that you don't love God enough. And this teaching is prevalent in the world today, just as it was prevalent in Job's day, and it was prevalent in Jesus' day. And it's very important that we recognize that God is too big to fit into any of our boxes for Him. There are things that He does in our lives that very often we don't understand, we don't know, and what He calls us to do is to trust Him in them. Want to kind of look at more closely the words of Eliphaz that we read earlier this morning in chapter 5, starting with verse 1. He says this, call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Well, he's saying to Job, do you have a mediator with God? Somebody who will fix this gap, breach this gap? I want you to know there is a mediator between people and God. That's Jesus. If you feel like you're cut off from God, you need to know God, you need a relationship with God, and you don't know how to get there, I want you to know it's through Jesus. Trust Jesus. Jesus is the bridge between you and the Father. Trust Jesus, and He will give you that relationship that you're looking for. Start again. Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Surely vexation kills the fool, and jealousy slays the simple. Notice here how he's comparing Job to a fool, some friend, right? I've seen the fool taking root, but suddenly I cursed his dwelling. There is self-righteousness there. His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate. Remember, Job's children were crushed in this terrible collapse of this home that they were in. There is no one to deliver them. The hungry eat his harvest, and he takes it even out of thorns, and the thirsty pant after his wealth. His crops are and remember, Job's crops are destroyed. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. He's saying to Job, these troubles that you're facing, they didn't just come out of nowhere. No, there's a root somewhere. And then he says, but man is born to trouble as sparks fly upward. Some translate this, but man is born to cause trouble. Job, the afflictions that are happening to you, the terrible things that are happening to you, they don't just come from nowhere. These are sprouting forth from the ground because you have planted the seeds that have led to this. And then listen to the self-righteousness again. As for me, I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth and sends waters on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as in the night. But he saves the needy from the sword of their mouth and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth. And what he's saying is Job needs to return to the Lord to experience restoration. And this is true, that when we return to the Lord, we receive restoration. But Job never turned away from the Lord. That's the point. And that's where Eliphaz is wrong. So he's taking these truths, he's mixing them with errors, and now he's coming up with false assumptions about Job because he's putting God in a box and he's assuming the way that God needs to act in the world. He says this, "Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves, and therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up, he shatters, but his hands heal." So there we have everything that's happening to Job makes sense to Eliphaz because Eliphaz has put God in a box. Now, on the other hand, we have Job, nothing makes sense to him in his suffering because he's also put God in a box. He's also put God in a box, and therefore it doesn't make sense. He can't imagine why he's going through this. He mentions in chapter 6, verses 6 and 7, Eliphaz, unsatisfying words, he says this, "Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the juice of the mallow? My appetite refuses to touch them. They are as food that is loathsome to me." He's saying, here you are. You came from a far off country. You're supposed to be here to comfort me and give me words that will help me. And the words that you're giving me are like tasteless food. They're unsatisfying. He goes on further. He says that their reaction to him and his trouble is a reaction out of their fear. He says this, "He withholds kindness." These are verses of chapter 6, verses 14 through 17. And then I'm going to read verse 21. He says this, "He who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. My brothers are treacherous as a torrent bed, as a torrential stream that pass away." So in the wilderness and in the areas that Job would have lived, they had these wadis, and these wadis would quickly fill with water if there were storms, or maybe in the winter the wadis would build and ice would cover them. And then as soon as the water came, the water would go away. So you'd have this big torrential overpouring of water, and then the water would disappear. And you can imagine if you're living in a dry wilderness and you see all that water, you're excited. But as soon as the water comes, the water goes, and it leaves itself unsatisfying. And that's exactly what he's saying about these comforters. Their words are like water he thinks is going to refresh his soul, but as soon as it comes, it goes, and he's just as dry and thirsty afterward as he was before. He goes on, "My brothers," and we'll look at verse 15 of chapter 6 again, "My brothers are treacherous as a torrent bed, as torrential streams that pass away, which are dark with ice, and where the snow hides itself. When they melt, they disappear. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. For you have now become nothing. You see my calamity and are afraid." What is he saying? He's saying that the reason why they're such miserable comforters is because they are afraid. They're acting on their fears. Rather than acting in trust in God, what are they afraid of? Now that's something that we have to ask ourselves. Well, maybe they're afraid of showing too much comfort to Job and maybe getting on the wrong side of God, and now God blasts them like he blasts Job. Sometimes we can do that. We are miserable comforters because we come to somebody who's hurting and we comfort them out of our own fears, and we see somebody going through a difficult time, and sometimes we pull away from them, or maybe we're cold toward them because we're afraid of our association with them for one reason or another. And like them, we become miserable comforters instead of joining them in their pain and the things that they're dealing with and walking with them through it and not assuming that we know the reason why they are suffering the way that they are. So in chapter 7, Job turns to God. He turns away from his friends and now he addresses God directly. Now, this is something that we're going to see in the story as we move along. Job's friends talk about God. Job talks to God. Job's friends know about God. Job knows God, and that makes all the difference. And maybe there's someone here today who's like that. Maybe you feel it more like Eliphaz than you feel like Job. Job had an intimate relationship with God, and so he could just cry out to him and talk to him. Now, last week we talked about how Leviathan was kind of symbolic of all the evil of this world system. And Leviathan was like a sea monster. And so Job returns to this theme. And he says, am I the sea or a sea monster? Am I the personification of evil in the world? He's saying this to God in chapter 7, verse 12. That you set a guard over me. When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint. Then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are a breath. He's crying out to God because he feels as if God won't leave him alone. Remember, here's Job by the town dump. He's got shards of pottery and he's scraping off the sores from his body. And he has a broken marriage and he's lost his kids and he's lost his possessions and he's lost everything. But worst of all, he feels like God has set against him. He feels like his relationship with God has changed and he can't figure out why. And he says, God, you won't give me a moment break from my pain and my agony. Even when I go to my couch and I try to go to sleep, I'm overcome by bad dreams. This is another way that Satan was attacking him. I don't know if you've ever known anyone who was afraid to go to sleep because of bad dreams. I had a friend once who visited me and stayed in my dorm room in college. And I thought it was strange. You wouldn't go to sleep. And I said, well, how come you won't go to sleep? And he said to me, I'm afraid to go to sleep because I have such terrible nightmares every night. Maybe there's people here who can identify with Job. Maybe you've dealt with that in your life where you're afraid to go to sleep because the nightmares are so terrible. But Job is saying, God won't let up on me every moment, every day. I can't even sleep in peace. He's broken. I don't know if you've ever been in a place of such brokenness in your life. Psalm 8 is a beautiful psalm, and it speaks about God's watchful care. And David, listen to how David talks about God's watchful care over him. He says in Psalm 8, 4 and 5, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. Beautiful, right? Psalm 139, beautiful, talks about there's nowhere we can go to escape God's presence. If we go into the depths, he is there. If we arise in the dawn on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. But that's not how Job thinks about God's watchful care. He says, almost using the same words as David in Psalm 8, he says, remember, David starts as, what is man that you're mindful of him? Listen to how Job starts his. What is man that you make so much of him? This is in verse 17 of chapter 7. And that you set your heart on him. Visit him every morning and test him every moment. How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone till I swallow my spit? He feels as if God won't even leave him alone to swallow his spit. God's eye is on him. He feels as if his life is so shattered that God won't give him a moment, won't give him a single second to himself. And he just pours out, he believes, his wrath on him. And of course, we know that God wasn't doing that. But that's what Job felt. And so we kind of get to the heart of Job's struggle. And really, in verse 21, we have the cry of every person who knows Jesus. He says this. Why do you not pardon my transgressions and take away my iniquity? Why does Job say that? On the one hand, he can't think of anything he's done that's directly caused what's happening to him. But he's saying to God, God, if I've done something, would you please just pardon me for it? I don't even know what it is. And then he says, for now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be. You know, it's interesting. Even though Job doesn't agree with Eliphaz, he really does. Eliphaz is saying, Job, you're suffering because you did something bad. Job is saying, well, I'm suffering. I must have done something bad. I just don't know what it is. Both of them have put God in a box. While we know, again, that the whole story is something completely different, that God is actually putting Job on display for the whole world to see, that when a person enters into union with him, into a relationship with him, he changes our hearts. He washes away our sin. And the reason why we love him and serve him isn't for all the other benefits that we receive. It's because we are in relationship with him. He is our true treasure. If you really know Jesus, Jesus is your true treasure. Well, I just want to make a few applications from this. Number one, we must not allow our circumstances to drive our relationship with the Lord. That's exactly what Job was doing. He was assuming that because his circumstances were bad, it meant his relationship with the Lord was bad. And therefore, he allowed that to drive him in his relationship with the Lord. You ever do that? Maybe a time in your life where you're really struggling with something, and maybe you're praying for something, praying hard, and you say, Lord, just this one thing, just give me this one thing. And then all of a sudden, whatever it is that you're praying for, whatever you sought, all of a sudden, that doesn't happen. Maybe it was a relationship, maybe it was a job, maybe it was getting into a particular school, whatever it was. Then it doesn't happen. And what often do we do? We can become angry with God. I know that I've done that in my life, where I've become angry with God because he didn't give me the thing that I wanted. But it's important that we not allow our circumstances to drive our relationship with God, that we trust him and who he is, and that he knows what is best for us in our life, even if it's a circumstance like Job was going through. Number two, we need to be careful in the way that we deal with broken people. We need to be careful in the way that we deal with broken people. In this text, we notice that these guys were operating out of their fears. They were afraid, perhaps, of somehow identifying so closely with Job that God would turn on them as well. And so as a result of it, they blast Job rather than entering into their pain with Job and walking through his pain with him. It's important to remember that when somebody we know is suffering and there is no link to some unwise action, we need not judge them. If somebody is suffering and there's a link between their suffering and some wise, unwise action, well, we need to walk through that with them in grace, pointing them in love to Jesus, not stepping back in fear and sort of becoming another hand of judgment on those people. Now, of course, there are times where the church has to enter into church discipline when a member wanders. But even that should always be done in love and grace and mercy and gentleness. Just like Paul says, for instance, in Galatians 6:1. The third thing is this, and this is a point that we made last week, but it's worth just mentioning again, and we'll probably mention it a lot more times. When you're broken, when I'm broken, he's always a place, a friend that we can run to. I love how in the midst of Job's distress and pain, finally, he just gives up on the friends, and now he turns to the Lord. And that's where he finds his comfort. And that's where he will throughout the book. It's a mark of someone who's in a relationship with him. Imagine saying that you're in a relationship, or imagine me saying I'm in a relationship with somebody, but never talking to them, never communicating to them, only talking about them. That's not a relationship. A relationship is when we talk to that person and interact with that person, and God is using Job's circumstances to call him to deeper intimacy of relationship. And then number four, God is bigger. God is bigger. Once we surrender to Christ, there is no need to surrender to anyone else. And we have Eliphaz. He has these preconceived notions of what Job ought to do. And Job, what does he do? He makes his final appeal to who? To God. Job isn't surrendering to Eliphaz. He's not going to surrender to the friends. He's going to keep appealing to God throughout the book. God is bigger than any of the boxes that we can put him into. But, you know, just one last thing to say about this. You know, Eliphaz believed that Job was rightfully suffering for the things that he did. Job believed, too, that he was suffering for something that he must have done, but he just couldn't figure out what it was. And all they wanted was relief. But, you know, you think about Jesus and what he did for us. Did Jesus ever sin? No. Jesus was completely righteous, right? And what did he do for us? Jesus took upon himself the penalty of our sin. He bore death and hell so that we don't have to on the cross, so that we could enjoy the work that he had done. Think about that for a second. Jesus took upon himself the penalty of our sin, the penalty for what we deserved, so that we could experience the fruit of the work of righteousness that he did. That's the beautiful thing about this, talk about this law of sowing and reaping and a law of retribution and all those things, and eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. Well, Jesus is our intermediary. Jesus is our substitute. He took our place. He bore our iniquity so that through him we might receive mercy and grace in his righteousness. So we have this beautiful picture that Paul gives us in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. It says this: for our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Jesus suffered for the sins that we committed so that we don't have to. What an amazing gift of grace. Do you know him? Do you have a relationship with him? You know, he can set you free from your sin. He can set you free from whatever you're dealing with. He can take away all your guilt and all your shame. That's what he did. He took your guilt, my guilt, shame upon himself, and he died for us on a cross, and he rose again from the dead so that all those who trust in him will live forever. Do you know him? Do you have a relationship with him? He will set you free and he will give you new life. And there's a joy that's found in him that's found nowhere else. Let's pray.